From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Lisa Mullins.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix. This is Here and Now. President Biden stepped off Air Force One in South Korea this morning, and one of his first stops was at a Samsung semiconductor factory, where he praised the company's investment in the U.S.
We'll create 3,000 new high-tech jobs in Texas and add to 20,000 jobs Samsung already supports in the United States of America.
Biden's trip also includes a stop in Japan over the weekend. NPR's Anthony Kuhn joins us now from Seoul. And Anthony, what's at the top of Biden's agenda for his first visit to Asia as president?
Economic security is going to be high on the agenda in both Seoul and Tokyo. And the idea of that is to protect the U.S. and its allies against economic coercion of the sort that they accuse China of, by which they mean squeezing off their supply of industrial inputs, getting sensitive technologies with military applications either by buying them or hacking them. It's also about outcompeting and outinvesting China in high-tech sectors, two of which South Korea is really a leader in, semiconductors, especially memory chips, and also electric vehicles and batteries. And besides the semiconductor plant that Samsung is building in Texas, automaker Hyundai is building an electric vehicle factory in Georgia. So that's actually both about geopolitics and local politics, as those plants are going to bring in lots of jobs. South Korea's new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, is expected to sign on to a new U.S. Indo-Pacific Economic Framework, which is a trade agreement partially intended to help compete with China.
President Yoon is not only new, he is very new, less than 2 weeks in the job, and he has said that he wants a closer relationship with the United States. What do you think he'll want to hear from President Biden?
Well, I think South Korea is already very happy about some of the early steps President Biden took to repair relations. Former President Trump threatened to withdraw U.S. troops if South Korea did not pay the U.S. more to base them in South Korea. Biden signed a new defense cost deal and reassured them about the U.S. commitment. And so that low-hanging fruit has basically been picked. The U.S. still has a lot of asks from South Korea, both in terms of joining them in confronting China and also supporting Ukraine against the Russian invasion. Now, the new president, Yoon Suk-yeol, has not really done anything to offend Beijing. He's maintained that he wants good ties with China. But if he does draw closer to Washington and Beijing somehow retaliates, I think he will want to know that President Biden and the U.S. have got his back.
Well, and speaking of the war in Ukraine, South Korea is sanctioning Russia for the invasion, but it hasn't sent any military aid like many other allies. Do you think that President Biden is going to press Yoon to do more on that front for the Ukrainians?
Well, it's certainly important to have both South Korea and Japan join in the sanctions on Russia, but neither ally was willing to send lethal military aid. They've both sent non-lethal stuff like body armor and first aid kits. It's possible the U.S. will want more. There are reports that the U.S. pressed South Korea to sell Ukraine some anti-aircraft missiles, and South Korea did not want to do that. Seoul's concern is that selling arms to Ukraine could drive Russia, China, and North Korea into a tighter bloc. And besides inflicting economic punishment on South Korea, they could also, for example, help North Korea with its nuclear weapons technology.
Well, right. And North Korea has some problems of its own that might impact this trip. COVID, for one, North Korea trying to contain its first outbreak of the pandemic. Do you think that will be on the two leaders' agenda?
Well, there's a lot of concern here in South Korea and elsewhere because cases are skyrocketing in North Korea from none last week or none that they admitted to over 2 million now. And the two presidents, according to Seoul, may discuss sending humanitarian aid to North Korea to help with this outbreak. But so far, North Korea has rejected all offers of vaccines and medical aid.
And how about that nuclear weapons test that North Korea is planning? Do you think it'll happen while President Biden is there?
That's certainly the concern. North Korea has already staged 16 missile test launches this year. There's also concern that they could test detonate their first atomic bomb since 2017 at an underground test site. North Korea is developing a lot of new weapon systems that it needs to test, and it's just waiting for the right time to get the maximum political impact, which would be about now. And South Korea says it has a contingency plan, which media reports here suggest could involve moving both presidents into a military command bunker if a test occurs while Biden's in town.
NPR's Anthony Kuhn reporting in Seoul. Lots to cover. Thanks for doing it for us, Anthony.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Now to Buffalo, where people are still trying to process the violent attack nearly a week ago. That's when a white gunman shot 13 people at a Tops supermarket. The suspect had posted a racist screed before the attack. 11 of the 13 people were black, including all 10 who died. 20-year-old Zaire Goodman is a store employee who survived being shot. His mother, Zanetta Everhart, spoke about the gunman on WGRZ in Buffalo.
I'm angry. My heart will never soften for him. This will never be a moment where there will be forgiveness. I will never, ever forgive him for coming into my home. My community is my home.
We're going to bring in now Reverend Charles H. Walker II, who is senior pastor of Mount Hope Community Church, not too far from the Tops Market where the shooting took place. We spoke with him earlier in the week. Welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tomorrow is going to be 1 week since the shooting. How are people in the community you have spoken with processing what happened?
You know, it's tough. It's very difficult, to say the least, on a continuing basis. And, you know, but we're trying to pull together and, you know, make the best of a horrific situation. But through love and, you know, compassion, you know, we'll get through this because we're Buffalo strong. But it's tough. It's extremely tough. I can't say it's not.
No, we even heard it in that mother's voice when she says, I will never forgive this man who's not yet been convicted. I will never forgive him for coming into our home. My community is my home. This is certainly difficult to process, difficult to deal with. Today, the first funeral is being held for one of the victims, 60-year-old Deacon Hayward Patterson. I know, Reverend, that you grew up with Deacon Patterson. You also knew two of the other victims. Can you tell us something about Deacon Patterson that you remember about him?
Yeah, we grew up since grammar school, and he's always been a, you know, a right-on-type individual, a man as he grew older, you know, loved his community, loved his church, the people. He would, you know, take people back and forth to the hospital. I'm sorry, to the Tops where they needed to go. Just an overall good gentleman. You know, again, like I said, we both grew up during the gang era, so we went through that part in our life. But, you know, God changed us, and he was in his church, State Tabernacle, and I'm in my church. But overall, just a wonderful brother, I have to say, a wonderful brother. It pained me so when I found out that he was one of the ones, you know, who got killed. And they are having a service as we speak.
So, you know, you're processing it just as your community is. How
yes.
are you doing? How are you navigating through this trauma?
I'm doing well, only because of the grace of God, in that not only have we been doing things down on Jefferson, my church is on Broadway, which the people were catching the bus from Broadway to Jefferson and down to Tops, because we had a Tops on Broadway, but they closed it down 3 years ago. So what I've been doing is focusing down by my church and helping people. Like the last couple of days, we've given out over 200 bags of grocery, Pampers, all kinds of things for the community, because upon talking with a lot of them, you know, they're kind of left out in the cold, if you will, because there's no, it's a desert. There's no supermarket from where we are on Broadway to down on Jefferson. And with that one being closed, they're kind of left out in the open. So Aubrey Calhoun, the CEO of Buffalo City Mission, you know, she called me and said, Pastor, what can I do? So she got her team together and brought all this food. Larigo's Meat Shop, a store, brought all kinds of food, donuts, french fries, chickens, all kinds of stuff. And that's what we've been doing at this end because, again, that store was a mainstay for a lot of people,
Yeah, you were one of those who were handing out bags of groceries to people. Now that the supermarket itself is closed, it was such a linchpin for the community. What are the main needs there? What has to be done first?
Well, with regard to their immediate needs, you know, first and foremost, it's food, because toward the end of the month, you know, they run low on this and run low on that. And I'm talking to the community people and seeing what it is that they need. because Aubrey has told me, Pastor, get me a list what their immediate needs are, and we'll put some things together. Not a problem. So I'm doing that, and we're going to continue, and that's how I'm able to navigate through this. And but still, it's on the front of my mind all that has happened. But knowing that we are still continuing to service people who need us now more than ever, you know, it gives me some type of solace where, you know, I'm okay. So that's what's keeping me going. My wife and I, we're Team Walker, as they call us, and we're just doing what we're supposed to.
Reverend Charles H. Walker II, Senior Pastor at Mount Hope Community Church in Buffalo, we wish you the best of luck. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me, and, you know, we're Buffalo strong.
With abortion rights on the verge of collapse, some conservatives have acknowledged that pregnant people will need more support. That was the message last year when Texas passed a law banning abortions after about 6 weeks, even in the case of rape or incest. When we spoke to Rebecca Parma with the Texas Right to Life, she said her group would help those women during pregnancy.
And that's why we also advocate on behalf of, you know, social service programs, like the Alternatives to Abortion program, to make sure that women have the counseling they need, the social services they need if they find themselves in these kinds of situations.
Those services include adoption. When Justice Alito wrote the leaked draft of his opinion overturning Roe v. Wade, he cited conservative arguments that someone who places a newborn for adoption today is likely to find a good home for the baby because there's so much demand. In a footnote, he cited a CDC report from 2008 describing the domestic supply of infants available for adoption as virtually non-existent. Well, that got the attention of people like Amy Christian. She was adopted and wrote an essay for NBC News saying that adoption is no solution if Roe is struck down. Amy, welcome.
Hi there, Peter. Thanks for having me.
I'm so interested in your perspective because this hits very close to home. You were born days before Roe was decided in 1973. You were then adopted. So help me understand why you've been writing that adoption is not a substitute for abortion.
Well, as you know, Peter, Roe is about privacy. It has nothing to do with pregnancy, birth, parenthood. It's not an alternative. Adoption is not a substitute for abortion because of the repercussions of forced pregnancy, forced birth, and forced surrender of a child. This is something that has huge repercussions on the women who are forced to go through something that they don't want to go through. And for the Supreme Court to turn this into something about creating a supply of infants for people who are experiencing infertility or who want to have children and can't for whatever reason, it's not an answer. It's not an answer.
Well, that makes me think of the oral arguments for the Mississippi abortion case at the Supreme Court when Justice Amy Coney Barrett, who has two adopted kids, said that safe haven laws, which allow a woman to leave her baby at a hospital or a fire station to eventually be adopted, that those take away the pressure of forced motherhood. How does that hit you?
That's exactly what I'm saying, that the trauma of pregnancy and the very trauma of forced birth, it doesn't do away with not having to raise a child. My birth mother, for example, who I met when I was 26 years old, never really moved past this emotionally. She could never forgive her own parents for, as she put it, forcing her to surrender me, forcing her. Even though, as you mentioned, I was born just days before Roe, I was born in New York, where since 1970, abortion was safe and legal. She didn't have the right to make her own choices. She was 16 years old when she was pregnant, and she went to her parents, and she wasn't allowed to make this choice on her own. And she never got over it. And she told me many years later that she wished that she could keep me, and it affected the rest of her life, and it affected me and the rest of my life. And that is incomparable to the trauma, if there is trauma, of abortion.
You've been public about your own unplanned pregnancy and the choice that you made to have an abortion later in life. Did you consider adoption?
Absolutely not. Other people talked to me about it and said that I should give my child the chance that I was given. And that made me think of when I was growing up, people asked me if I wasn't grateful that I wasn't aborted. And that's a, I mean, that's a rhetorical question. Of course, I'm grateful I wasn't aborted. But if I had been aborted, I couldn't answer that question. What I am grateful for is to be alive and to be able to be an activist for women's rights and to be an adoptee saying that I'm proudly pro-choice.
Amy Christian, stay with us just a few minutes because I do want to bring in journalist Gabrielle Glazer, who has written a book about the history of adoption. It is called American Baby. We've spoken about it on this program. It takes a deep look at what happened in the middle of last century when abortion was illegal, at a time when millions of unmarried women were forced to give birth in shame and in secrecy and then hand their babies over in closed adoption. So, Gabrielle Glazer, welcome back to the program. It's good to speak with you again.
Hi, Peter. Thanks so much for having me.
So, Amy and many other babies and their birth mothers were a part of what's called the baby scoop era. So, when you hear her story and you reflect on that time, like, do you hear echoes of history resurfacing today?
Oh, I absolutely do. The baby scoop, as you just mentioned, was a period during which about 4 million American women, mostly unwed, were forced to surrender the sons and daughters they had conceived at a time when there was no sex education, very little birth control, and, of course, the period before Roe and the decades between the end of World War II and 1973 really can show us a lot about what a post-Roe future might look like.
And so when you hear some Republicans say, if there is less abortion, there will be more adoption, what do you say?
I say that the rate of placement during the baby scoop era among unwed women, in other words, women who were sort of forced, like Amy's mother, to relinquish their children into this very lucrative and exploitative adoption system that ran nationwide, they really had no choice. Society dictated that unwed women were bad girls. And today, that narrative has shifted quite a bit, but very few of them choose to actually place. I think today we know the difficulties of adoption, the lifelong grief that birth mothers face, the lifelong anxiety and wondering that many adoptees live with the rest of their lives. So this is not just a simple transaction that we can fill in the blanks and say, oh, place your child, put your baby in a safe haven, no questions asked, everything will work out fine. We know better than that today.
I heard you use the word lucrative referring to adoption agencies in the middle of last century, and that's one of the reasons why a lot of people were concerned, or at least their ears perked up when they heard Justice Alito in his draft opinion mention the CDC report and use that phrase, domestic supply of infants. How do you interpret that?
I agree with you. I think many people outside the adoption community were shocked. But to adoptees and birth parents and adoptive parents, I think that there was an understanding, certainly, that that is a reality, and it has been a reality in adoption for at least the last 100 years.
Do you think there's a risk that the adoption industry could turn into that once again?
Yes, I do. I know that the demand for infants in particular is extremely high. I did see a statistic, and I would take this with a grain of salt because it came from a lobbying group in Washington, but it suggests an incredibly lopsided ratio of prospective parents who are seeking to adopt and the number of babies who are surrendered each year. I think I saw a number that said around 20,000, and the number of people seeking to adopt is roughly 1 million.
On the other hand, so much has changed. Open adoptions are much more common than they used to be. The shame and the stigma, you've mentioned this, it's still there, but it has lessened to a great degree. Do you see a chance that expanded adoptions that might actually be a good thing and that things could be different from the baby scoop era?
Oh, I think there's hope to certainly believe that could be the case. And I know that there are a lot of wonderful integrated open adoptions in which adoptees are very aware of who they come from, who is raising them, what it means to come from a large, expanded, blended family. I think if it's done right, it can be a wonderful thing. But the key message to that is doing it the right way with the adoptee's heart in mind.
Amy Christian, if you're still there, I'd like to bring you back before we close out here and get your thoughts on this. This is Gloria Purvis. She's a conservative. She's against abortion rights. She was on our show recently. And she said that encouraging adoption shouldn't actually be the priority if Roe ends.
No, I don't think anybody should be coerced into giving up their child. I'd much rather have us have services that actually help these mothers keep their children. But in the cases of women who absolutely are sure they cannot keep their child, then I think we should help them as much as possible. I'm not sure it will, that adoptions will increase. I'm not sure.
I wonder what your thoughts are. Do you think that if someone had offered your birth mom more help, more support back in 1973, 1972, that your story would have turned out differently, that hers would?
Yes. Yes, I do. I do, Peter. Most birth parents are young, under-resourced, don't have health insurance. Perhaps they're lacking education. And I absolutely think that if they had different resources and their situations were different, then the families and these stories would turn out differently. I think she's 100% right.
Do you have hope that it might actually happen if or when Roe falls, that they would get that support?
No, I don't. Because I don't think that's what the conservative right is looking for. When we saw that phrase, domestic supply of infants, I think the answer was there, unfortunately.
Amy Christian is an adoptee and a writer. We're going to link you to her op-ed at hereandnow.org. Also, Gabrielle Glazer, a journalist and the author of the book American Baby. Thank you both so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for having us.
Mortgage interest rates are spiking. This as housing demands outstrips housing supply and the Federal Reserve tries to tamp down inflation. The situation is driving more buyers to apply for adjustable rate mortgages so they can buy a home. Mike Regan joins us now. He is senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Lisa.
So the Mortgage Bankers Association says demand for adjustable rate mortgages hit a 14-year high last week. Now, for those who are not familiar with adjustable rate mortgages, what are they and what does it tell you that buyers are increasingly interested in them?
Right. So with most mortgages, they're what's called a fixed rate mortgage, which means you lock in an interest rate for 15 or 30 years. With an adjustable rate mortgage, you lock it in for a much shorter time, in most cases, usually between 5 and 10 years. And then after that, the interest rate and your monthly payments as a result, it fluctuates with interest rates in the market, depending on what benchmark rate is chosen by the lender. And buyers are interested in them simply, as you pointed out, because traditional fixed mortgage rates have just risen quite rapidly this year. They're now in the neighborhood of 5.25% to 5.4%. And adjustable rates can be much lower, a full percentage point or more lower than those fixed rates, at least for that initial period before they adjust. So you're taking on that risk that rates could go higher by the time they adjust in exchange for that lower rate in the near term.
And by the way, wasn't there a time when 5 or 6% was really good?
Yes. Yeah. I think that was my first house.
Right. So the mortgages were a problem in the housing crash because people got stuck with high rates that they just couldn't pay. So what are the chances the same thing could happen this time around?
Well, it's certainly something to keep an eye on, but there are some pretty big differences between the run-up to the housing crash and now. For one thing, when you apply for an adjustable rate mortgage these days, it typically requires a lot more documentation, larger down payments, and higher credit scores than it did in the early 2000s. And back then, it also used to be more common for these rates to adjust more quickly, say after just 1 year, which can be much harder for a borrower to deal with, especially if the value of their home has also gone down. So those type of situations have sort of been corrected since the housing crisis. But certainly the growth in demand for these adjustable rates is something to keep an eye on.
There are other troubling signs in the lending markets. Default rates for people with low credit scores are going up. More so-called subprime borrowers are missing payments on car loans, on personal loans, credit cards. What does all of this mean? Is this a post-pandemic correction, or do you think it's something that's more concerning?
Well, delinquency rates across the board went way, way down in 2020 and 2021 because people just weren't able to go out and spend money like they used to. And there was all this supplemental unemployment payments and other stimulus. So they were bound to sort of normalize to some degree. But with the Federal Reserve raising interest rates as aggressively as it is, it's definitely worth watching to make sure it doesn't escalate into something worse.
And very briefly, stock market tanked this week. How concerning is this?
It's concerning. You know, everyone's worried about the signal it sends about a possible recession. The economists we survey put that at about a 30% chance of a recession in the next year, which is a little too high for comfort. Mm-hmm. So it is concerning.
All right. We'll talk about that again, I'm sure. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Thank you, as always.
Thank you, Lisa.
In Mexico, the number of people officially listed as disappeared topped 100,000 this week. Mexico began recording reports of missing people back in the 1960s, but numbers really shot up after 2006 when Mexico launched its war on drugs. Relatives of the disappeared and human rights activists say authorities must do more to stop what the UN says is a tragedy of enormous proportions. NPR's Carrie Kahn reports.
Virginia Garay says in February of 2018, her 19-year-old son Brian left the house and never came back.
Salió a trabajar, nunca llegó a su trabajo y no regresó a casa.
He went to work, she says, just 3 blocks from their home in the Pacifico state of Nayarit, where he sold hot dogs. But he never made it to work. She's never stopped looking for him. Literally, we dig in the dirt looking for the disappeared, she says. Garay is part of a growing number of mothers and relatives digging around Mexico, unearthing clandestine graves, since she says authorities do little to solve these crimes. According to investigative journalist Marcela Turate with the group Quinto Elemento Lab, the majority of the disappeared are young men, most likely caught up in drug trafficking, but there are many others not in the trade.
It can be like journalists, human rights defenders, defenders of land, indigenous people. Everybody can be disappeared because the impunity allows it.
Very few crimes in Mexico are ever solved, and fewer lead to a conviction. Disappearances have spiked in the last 2 years, despite promises by current President Andrés Manuel López Obrador.
Vamos a hacer todo lo que esté de nuestra parte, todo lo que humanamente sea posible.
We will do everything humanly possible to stop this, he said in 2019, just months after taking office. Critics say that promise wasn't realized, but López Obrador says his strategy against violence will take time. Virginia Garay, whose son has never been found, says relatives are inconsolable, devastated, and exhausted.
Yo podría dar muchísimos calificativos y ninguno.
I can rattle off many more adjectives, but none are enough to relay the desperation of not knowing where your loved one is, she says. Carrie Kahn, NPR News, Mexico City.
Early this year, Svetlana Poklyatska was enjoying life in Ukraine. She had pink and green street hair and lots of friends. She was in the midst of a gap year after high school, and she was spending it at a special academy in Kharkiv studying leadership. In late February, Russia invaded Ukraine. Svetlana and her classmates volunteered to weave camouflage nets for the Ukrainian military to hide equipment. By March, her parents felt things were too dangerous, so Svetlana, her mother and younger brother, fled to Massachusetts. They're among the Ukrainians who've come to the U.S. since the war started. President Biden has promised to accept up to 100,000 Ukrainians. Svetlana and her family are living at her uncle's house in the leafy town of Sharon, Massachusetts, south of Boston. Svetlana says she couldn't help but notice when she got here. The mood was lighter and there were no guns in sight.
When I first came here, a lot of people smiling and I just, oh my God. When you move from a place where people are going with guns on the street, you can trust no one, and then you move here and you see a lot of people that smiling.
And students are friendly at Sharon High School. Svetlana takes classes here. Kids have put yellow and blue posters supporting Ukraine in the windows. Assistant Superintendent Meg Dussault describes 18-year-old Svetlana as sophisticated and confident, but still kid-like, despite the upheaval she's experienced.
I think that we have an image of war. We think of the travesty and the hurt and all of these things. And then you see this pink phone case and little rainbow barrettes. And in spite of everything, the war hasn't robbed her of that.
But Svetlana carries the war with her. She checks in with her friends in Ukraine all the time.
When you talk to them, how does it feel to be here?
Actually, I feel really guilty that I'm here and not there. When I saw the pictures of Kharkiv, where I was living for a lot of months, I can't believe it's true. Kharkiv is damaged 80%, so it's very painful.
She sets those thoughts aside for the moment. Class is about to start. She scoots off in her baggy fringe-bottom jeans and Doc Marten boots. Her hair is different now. She's bleached out the green and pink and left it several shades of blonde.
Do I need, like, I don't know, tell me what to do.
Oops, she's taken a wrong turn.
Yeah, so we're walking not the right hall.
Someone points her in the right direction. Even though Svetlana got her diploma in Ukraine, she has a goal at Sharon High.
While here, I'm just learning English.
She gets help learning English from teacher Karina Kerr. Today they work on an editing exercise.
So there's going to be 10 errors there, and you can look for any grammatical errors or spelling errors that you see.
Svetlana reads a passage out loud.
The Brooklyn Bridge in New York City was the first opened to the public on May 1883.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The bridge spans the East River and connects the...
So that word, what is this word? That word is boroughs?
Boroughs of Brooklyn and Manhattan.
Kerr has taught English to students who've come from other places in turmoil, including Haiti. She says some of them are willing to talk about what they've endured, others are not.
I basically leave it up to the student what they would like to share. A third grader might not fully conceptualize war. But when an older student kind of knows so much about the horrors of war, it's just a much more difficult conversation. It's much more important to me to be respectful of people's stories and their privacy.
Some students at Sharon High are also trying to be sensitive about Svetlana having fled a war. Tiago Rodriguez, for one.
I was really worried because I was like, oh, God. The last thing I want is for her to just try and live her life. And everyone's like, so, sis, how's Ukraine? But from what I've seen, that's not what's happened. It's just like, what kind of food do you like? What are you into? Tell me your music. What's the interpersonal things that you would ask other people just in general?
Do you want to give an interview?
Senior students Alice Zanuski and Amelia Desari have become Svetlana's friends and tour guides. They show her all around.
Shaw's, very exciting. Macy's, Red Lentil, just hidden gems in the town.
Svetlana's happy for the diversions. But she's clear she's on a mission in this country. She wants to keep Ukraine in the public eye. And one way to do that is to talk to the media.
I believe that media noise will help hold the public attention to the situation. And if public attention is held, states or government of different countries are really trying to help.
So this is your part? Like, this interview is your part in that, to try and influence public opinion and therefore try to influence governments.
I hope for it. All my plans on future are cancelled, by the circumstances, and now I need to adapt and plan from now. What can I do, and where can I be useful?
The war in Ukraine has left cities in ruins and lives shattered, but for Svitlana, the devastation has sealed her sense of purpose. She looks ahead to a post-war Ukraine and says she wants to help lead the country to a strong, dynamic future.
In every field, there's need a leader. For a leadership, you need a vision, and for vision, you need to be competent in your field. I hope I will be that person who could give example and vision to others.
Svitlana is applying to colleges in the U.S. and Europe. Meanwhile, the school day ends in Sharon. She talks about the upcoming prom. Her friends have convinced her to go. She says a quick goodbye, heads out the door, and looks at her cell phone to catch up on what she's missed.
A Pennsylvania mom is suing TikTok. Her 10-year-old daughter died allegedly after doing a challenge on social media that encourages people to hold their breath or restrict their own breathing until they pass out. It's called the Blackout Challenge. Here's mom, Tawana Anderson.
It's time that these dangerous challenges come to an end, that other families don't experience the heartbreak we live every day.
Anderson found her daughter unconscious in her bedroom in early December. The girl died at the hospital 5 days later. Let's bring in here and now social media correspondent Femi Okay. She's host of The Stream on Al Jazeera. And Femi, do want to warn people that this is going to be a tough conversation for people to hear, but an important one, especially for parents here. So why don't we start with this wrongful death lawsuit? What kind of argument is the mom in this case making?
The mom is arguing with her lawyers that there was wrongful death, there's a products liability negligence against TikTok, they're holding the social media platform accountable for the death of 10-year-old Nyla Anderson, saying that their product, the TikTok platform, is defective and dangerous.
Nyla was described by her mom as happy, healthy, incredibly intelligent. She spoke three languages before she died. Here's the family's attorney, Jeffrey Goodman.
Nyla Anderson was sent a how-to video on how to asphyxiate yourself. She was sent this video by TikTok after TikTok identified through their algorithms that they thought this video was appropriate to send to a 10-year-old.
So just terrible that this happened, but describe what the challenge is, if you could. How common is it that young kids are seeing these videos and then doing the challenge?
Absolutely. And just to explain what the lawyer actually just said, Jeffrey just said there, is that there is a page on TikTok called For You Page, and it curates videos that you might like to enjoy, you might like to follow. And all of those videos using an algorithm are sent to you as a TikTok user. So one of the videos that was sent to Nyla was the Blackout Challenge. There have been a number of youngsters who've died taking the Blackout Challenge, including one little boy in Colorado last August. And several challenges, and Peter, you and I have talked about this over the years, challenges where youngsters are doing things that are really dangerous. There's the fire mirror challenge, for instance, where you throw flammable liquid at a mirror and then you light it. Youngsters have injured themselves doing that. There's a Benadryl challenge where you drink enough Benadryl to hallucinate and then you film yourself. There's a NyQuil chicken cooking challenge where you cook chicken with NyQuil and then you eat it. I don't need to explain how dangerous that might be. And then the skull breaker challenge. These are just a few of them. You jump up in the air, people either side of you, knock your legs out from underneath you. Lots of children have injured themselves doing that. There are so many of these challenges online right now. And kids are doing them. They're thinking that they're playful. They're thinking they won't get hurt. I spoke to Dr. Faisha Bashola, who's a pediatrician, psychiatrist, and she says with youngsters, they're still pruning, they're still maturing, their brains are still developing and making connections. So fitting in is more important than the danger of what they might be doing by taking on one of these challenges.
But, you know, I remember people doing the Blackout Challenge when I was a kid, and this was in the late 80s, early 90s, yeah. And this was long before TikTok or any kind of social media was happening. So what is it that makes TikTok stand out enough to be the target of a lawsuit? Is it this algorithm that you were talking about?
The algorithm, the showing the videos to you and saying, these videos are literally for you. But TikTok pick up on the idea that you just mentioned there, Peter, that these challenges have been around for a long time. They called the blackout challenge a disturbing challenge, but it predates the platform and it has never been a TikTok trend. I'm looked into what are TikTok doing right now in terms of safeguarding youngsters. They've asked people, users, to report dangerous content. On the right side of every video, there's a little white arrow. You click on that arrow and you can report the video. They've also removed hashtags. But of course, that doesn't remove all of the dangerous videos. They're still out there.
They are out there. And as the parent of a teenager, it is very stressful to know that there's no way I'm going to know what the latest challenge is until these kids are already doing them. So what do you think parents can do to protect their kids, their families?
So going back to Tawana Anderson, the mum that we heard at the very beginning when we started talking, she says, check your child's phone, know what they're looking at. And then the pediatrician, psychiatrist, Dr. Faisha Bashola, she said, fill your child's day with healthy activities so that they're not bored. They use less social media. And also check yourself. Are you on social media all the time? Maybe you need to get off social media and then make sure that your youngster doesn't have a void where they can get themselves into mischief. And you may well just be saving them from harm and maybe something even worse than that.
My goodness. All right. Here and now, social media correspondent Femi OK, host of Al Jazeera's The Stream. Thank you for taking a look at this social media trend and all the trends that you talked to us about here. Thanks very much, Femi.
You're very welcome. This could be historic, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd in Phoenix.
And I'm Lisa Mullins in Boston. This is Here and Now.